Welcome back to the deep dive. And I have to be honest with you, the stack of papers you sent over for today's discussion, it really kept me up last night.
Yeah, it's not exactly light reading, is it?
No, not at all. Because usually when we dig into economics or global systems, we're looking at it like mechanics.
Right, a machine.
Exactly. We talk about the gears of supply chains, the levers of interest rates, the steam engine of inflation. It's all very industrial.
Very detached.
Yeah. But the source material we are covering today, it completely throws that out. It doesn't look at the economy as a machine. It looks at it as a body.
And the diagnosis it offers is pretty much terminal.
It is a heavy one today. We are dissecting John McMurtry's The Cancer Stage of Capitalism.
And I know, I mean, as soon as you hear that title,
Yeah.
your brain probably puts up a defensive shield right away.
Oh, totally. You think, okay, here comes the hyperbole.
Right, because
Degla.
we use that word cancer for everything we don't like in modern society. That we say corruption is a cancer or, social media is a cancer.
Yep.
It's usually just a metaphor for something bad that is spreading.
Exactly. But that is the crucial pivot point we have to make right at the start of this deep dive. McMurtry is a philosopher, but he is arguing this from a standpoint of rigorous pathology.
So he's not just being poetic.
Not at all. He is saying, literally, put the slide under the microscope. Look at the behavioral patterns of the global market system.
Look at how it replicates.
Yes. Look at how it consumes resources. Look at how it relates to the host organism.
Which is us, society, the biosphere, the planet.
Exactly. His argument is that if you show those specific patterns to a pathologist without telling them it was the economy,
they would have only one diagnosis.
Right. They would say, this is a carcinoma. It's not like a cancer. Structurally, behaviorally, the system actually is one.
That is just such a terrifying premise, because if the economy is the tumor, that makes society the host.
And we all know what happens to the host if the tumor wins.
The host dies.
The host dies. And that is the stakes of what we're getting into today. We are talking about a recession or a temporary market correction.
We are talking about what the text calls a system-wide collapse.
Because, as he argues, our economic system has become completely life-blind.
Mm-hmm.
And we will get into exactly what that term means. But essentially, it is systematically dismantling the life support systems of the planet.
Environmental, biological, social, all of it.
Right.
It sounds like the plot of a horror movie, to be honest, but we're living in it. However, before anyone pulls the ripcord, because this just sounds way too bleak, we need to mention there is a prescription.
Yes, the text doesn't just say, we're doomed, let's pack it in. It actually offers a cure.
Right. It introduces this concept called the civil commons and something called life capital.
Which is actually a very hopeful, very grounded solution.
But like any surgery, you can't fix the problem until you admit the patient is sick.
So we have to start with the diagnosis.
Let's scrub in then. The core of McMurtry's argument starts with a conflict. A war between two totally different value systems.
Yes. The money sequence versus life capital.
Now, I think most of us listening understand money, but life capital is a new term for a lot of people.
So let's break down the money sequence first, because that is the genetic code of the cancer itself.
Okay, how does he define it?
To understand it, we have to look at how economics used to be described, even by early critics like Marx. You had a basic formula. Money leads to a commodity, which leads to more money.
Like you have cash, you buy wood, you buy some labor, you build a chair.
Right, the chair is the commodity.
And then you sell the chair for a profit, so you end up with more money than you started with.
Exactly. The commodity step, the actual making of the chair, was essential. It was tethered to the real world. You had to produce something of actual use to somebody to get the return.
You had to do something physical. The money was just a tool to facilitate the creation of the useful thing.
But McMurtry argues the system has mutated over time. That middle step, the commodity, is disappearing. It's becoming completely irrelevant.
So the new formula is just...
just money leading to it. More money.
Yeah.
Pure multiplication. The system no longer cares how the money multiplies.
It's uncoupled from reality.
Completely. You could be growing organic food, or you could be betting against a developing country's currency and bankrupting their entire economy.
To the money sequence, those two actions are literally identical.
As long as the return on investment is the same, yes.
It is entirely value neutral when it comes to life.
It is life blind. That's his core phrase. Think of it like a cell in your body. A healthy liver cell works to support the liver, right?
Mm.
It differentiates. It has a specific job that serves the whole.
But a cancer cell de-differentiates.
Exactly. It doesn't care about the liver's function anymore. Its only goal is to become two cells.
And then four, then eight.
It treats the organ it lives in not as a home, but just as a resource dump to be consumed to fuel its own endless replication.
That is the money sequence. It just seeks to turn money into more money, regardless of the consequences to the host.
Which brings us to the opposing force in this text, life capital.
I really love this term because it puts a hard, serious economic value on things we usually just take for granted, things we consider free.
Yes, and this is the antidote to the money sequence. Life capital is defined in the source as any wealth that produces more life without loss.
Because we usually think of capital as just cash in the bank or maybe factory machinery.
But McMurtry says, no, look at the biological reality of our existence. Clean air is life capital.
Potable water.
Potable water is life capital, but it goes beyond just the environment. It is social, too. Knowledge is life capital.
Social trust, like living in a neighborhood where you don't have to lock your doors at night.
That is incredibly valuable life capital. A functional public immune system, a healthcare network, that is life capital.
It's basically the stuff that actually makes life worth living, or even physically possible in the first place.
And here is the pathology he identifies, the conflict. The money sequence grows by feeding on that life capital.
It extracts it.
It is not creating value out of thin air, even though it looks like it is. It is extracting it from the host. If a corporation pollutes a river to make a cheap, fast fashion t-shirt, the money sequence has increased.
Because they made a profit.
Right. But they have burned life capital. They have literally converted a living, life-supporting system into dead numbers in a bank account.
This really rewires how you look at the evening news. Because
mm-hmm.
we hear, oh, GDP's up this quarter, and we all cheer.
We are so conditioned to think that if the stock market is hitting record highs, the country must be healthy.
But McMurtry points out this blind spot in economics, something called the goods fallacy. Standard economics calls literally everything a good.
It is a linguistic trap, and it blinds us to the reality of the cancer. In Econ 101, a good is just anything that is sold in the market.
So a fresh salad is a good?
Yes. And a pack of cigarettes is also a good.
A semi-automatic weapon is a good.
A barrel of toxic waste. If a company pays another company to transport it and dump it, that is a transaction of goods. It adds to the GDP.
But the text gets even darker here, because he points out that the remedy for the damage caused by these goods is also added to the GDP.
Yes, and this is where you really see the life blindness.
Give me a concrete example of that from the source, because honestly, it sounds so counterintuitive.
Okay, imagine a giant corporation produces ultra-processed junk food. It is scientifically engineered to be addictive, but it causes severe heart disease and diabetes over time.
Right. So the sales of that addictive food drive the GDP up.
Yeah.
That gets reported as growth. The shareholders are thrilled.
Exactly. But then, a few years later, the consumers get incredibly sick.
So they need bypass surgery. They need lifelong pharmaceuticals. They need long-term nursing care.
And all of those medical services are sold on the market, which means they also drive the GDP up.
Wait, so the system registers the cause of the disease and the treatment of the disease as a massive double win.
Correct. The misery is highly profitable. The actual destruction of human life is registered on the ledger as an economic boom.
That is insane.
He uses environmental examples too. If you have a standing forest, an old growth forest that protects a valley town from mudslides, how much is that worth to the GDP?
Zero. Because no one is buying or selling it. It's just sitting there being nature.
Right. But if a logging company cuts it all down and sells the timber, the GDP goes up.
And then when the heavy rains come and the mudslide hits because the tree roots are gone.
And it destroys the town below.
The emergency response, the construction contracts to rebuild the shattered town, all of that drives the GDP up again.
It is an accumulation of bads masquerading as growth.
It is entirely perverse. We are quite literally counting our own destruction as progress. But how do economists, I mean people with PhDs, how do they just miss this? How do smart people not see that we are cannibalizing ourselves?
Well, the source argues they don't miss it. They just categorize it differently so they don't have to deal with it. They call it externalities.
Externalities? That is the rug they sweep the cancer under.
Exactly. Standard economic theory says that pollution or spike in depression or social decay, those are just accidental side effects of the market.
Like, oops, we made a mess. We'll just fix it later with a small tax credit or a fine.
But McMurtry argues that is a fundamental lie. These aren't accidents. They are the actual fuel for the system.
The cancer creates its profits specifically by dumping its true costs onto the host.
Yes. If that junk food company actually had to pay for the millions of heart surgeries their product caused, they wouldn't be profitable at all. They would be bankrupt instantly.
So the business model requires them to externalize the death. To survive, they have to push the biological bill onto the rest of us.
They feed on the host's reserves, take the financial profit, and leave the biological deficit behind.
Okay, so if this is the diagnosis, a lifeblood cancer feeding on life capital, how long have we been this sick? Was capitalism always this terminal?
He actually pinpoints a specific mutation, a moment in time where we went from a flawed but somewhat grounded system to a fully malignant tumor.
A patient zero moment. And the source material points right at the mid-1970s, specifically in 1973.
Yes, 1973 is the critical turning point in his analysis.
Which was an incredibly chaotic time. You had Nixon, Watergate, the Vietnam War dragging on, the massive oil crisis. What specifically happened in the DNA of the economy right then?
The end of the gold standard. The United States officially decoupled the dollar from gold.
Now, we need to clarify, this isn't about being a gold bug or saying everyone needs to carry around heavy coins again, right?
No, it is about the concept of limits. When money was tied to gold, it was tied to physical planetary reality. You needed physical labor and actual geology to get more gold out of the ground.
You couldn't just hallucinate wealth into existence. There was a physical anchor holding the system to the earth.
Exactly. You couldn't just print $1 trillion because you didn't possess $1 trillion worth of physical gold. But in 1973, that tether was permanently cut.
Money became pure fiat.
Pure fiat. Pure law. It became a symbol that only referenced itself. And this is the mutation. This allowed the banking sector, Wall Street, to start creating credit.
Which is really just a polite word for debt.
In infinite amounts. The money sequence was suddenly unchained from the physical world. It could multiply mathematically, exponentially, without having to produce anything real at all.
And the text directly links this desperate shift to the Vietnam War, right? The U.S. was basically broke.
Yes. The U.S. government had racked up immense unsustainable debts funding the war overseas and the Great Society programs at home. They literally couldn't pay their international obligations in gold anymore. They didn't have enough in the vaults.
So instead of admitting defeat, they just changed the rules of global finance.
And this birthed what we call the petrodollar. This is a crucial, crucial shift in the cancer's development. The U.S. dollar wasn't backed by a shiny metal anymore. It became backed by oil.
Specifically by an agreement that global oil had to be traded in dollars and backed by the military force required to enforce those oil markets.
Right. So the reserve currency of the entire world became anchored to a pollutant and a war machine.
Talk about a grim omen for the future. You anchor your entire global value system to the very resource that is actively destabilizing the biosphere.
And simultaneously, you had a political mutation happening alongside this financial one. The shock doctrine.
Right, because 1973 wasn't just the gold standard. It was also the year of the coup in Chile.
September 11, 1973, a democratically elected socialist government led by Salvador Allende was violently overthrown with international backing.
And they brought in this group known as the Chicago Boys.
Economists, trained in the United States, steeped in this pure free market ideology. And they treated Chile like a living laboratory.
They ushered in these intense shock treatments. They privatized public assets. They crushed the labor unions. They completely dismantled the social safety net.
McMurtry looks at this from a medical perspective. Mm. He calls this destroying the immune system.
If you view things like unions, public regulations, and government oversight as the T cells of a society, the things that keep the tumor in check.
Then Chile was where the cancer learned how to actively suppress the host's immune system entirely. They proved that you could use state force and crisis to impose a pure, unregulated money sequence logic on an entire population.
And then once the experiment worked there, it spread. From the 1980s onward, with figures like Reagan and Thatcher, that exact model went global.
And they used debt as the primary delivery mechanism for the disease.
How exactly does that work? How is debt a delivery mechanism?
Well, imagine a developing nation in the global South needs a loan to build infrastructure. The World Bank or the IMF steps in and says, okay, we will give you the money. But it comes with strict conditions.
Structural adjustment program.
Exactly. They say, to get this money, you have to slash your public health budget. You have to sell off your publicly owned water utilities to private corporations. You have to remove labor protections and open your markets to our transnational companies.
McMurtry describes this not as a loan, but as bleeding the patient to feed the banks.
It deliberately forced the host nation to lower its social defenses so the cancer could enter and extract the life capital.
Which brings us to the present day. the metastasis. The cancer has spread everywhere now. And the mechanism for this total invasion is what the text calls financialization.
Yes.
There is a statistic in the source material that genuinely stopped me cold when I read it. The 97% figure.
That is the big one. It fundamentally changes how you understand the wallet in your pocket. We all grow up watching cartoons where the government is running printing presses, physically making the money.
But that's a myth.
It is largely a myth. In reality, the source points out that roughly 97% of the money circulating in our economy is created by private for-profit banks when they issue debt.
Not by the government as legal tender, by private banks.
It is just digital entries on a screen.
Yeah.
When you go to a bank and take out a mortgage to buy a house, the bank is not lending you someone else's deposited savings.
They literally type numbers into a computer.
They create that specific money out of absolutely nothing, and they create it as a debt that you now owe them.
So almost all the money in existence is actually just debt.
And because it is debt, it has to be paid back with interest attached.
And there is the mathematical trap.
To pay back the original principal plus the new interest, the overall economy must grow. It has no choice.
Because if the bank creates $100 in the money supply, but your debt contract requires you to pay back $105, where does that extra $5 come from? It doesn't exist yet.
Exactly. It has to be created by someone else taking out more loans. So we have designed a global operating system that is mathematically mandated to expand exponentially forever.
On a planet with strictly finite boundaries, it sounds like a Ponzi scheme.
It behaves exactly like one. But it is entirely legal and normalized. It is the core cancer equation. Unregulated exponential growth or total systemic collapse. Those are the only two options this current system allows for.
And since the real economy, you know, regular people buying cars and toasters and haircuts, since that is largely saturated, the money sequence has to find new places to feed. It has to keep growing.
So it invades the public sector.
This explains so much. This is why there is this relentless decades-long push to privatize absolutely everything.
Schools, public hospitals, national parks, the postal service. The text describes this as invading the life support systems of the host.
The tumor looks at a functioning public utility and says, hey, that water treatment plant isn't a human right. That is an untapped profit center.
There's a quote in the source material, a direct quote from a chief economist at Citibank, Willem Buiter, that is just chilling when you read it through this lens.
Yeah, let me pull that up. He says, water is the single most important physical commodity-based asset class.
Asset class. Let that sink in. He is not talking about the biological basis of all life on Earth, the stuff we will literally die without in 3 days.
He is salivating over it as a financial instrument.
To the cancer, scarcity is not a tragedy. Scarcity is an incredible profit opportunity. If fresh water becomes scarce, the price skyrockets. If the price skyrockets, the money sequence grows exponentially.
So the system is structurally incentivized to actually withhold the basic necessities of life to drive up the share price.
If every human being on Earth had free, abundant, clean drinking water provided by the commons, the GDP of the private water sector would be zero.
Which standard economics would view as a massive market failure.
Exactly. The health of the host is a failure to the tumor.
Now, I want to touch on something in the text that might be controversial for some listeners, the section on green energy.
Right. This requires some careful navigation.
Because you would assume McMurtry, who is clearly terrified of ecological collapse, would be all in on solar and wind and biofuels. But he actually calls a lot of corporate green energy a scam.
We have to be very nuanced here to accurately represent his argument.
Right.
He's absolutely not a climate change denier. He is desperately trying to save the biosphere.
But he is looking at the mechanism.
Yes. He argues that corporate green energy often just follows the exact same cancer logic. It isn't genuinely trying to save the host. It's just a mutated tumor finding a socially acceptable new way to feed on public subsidies.
Take biofuels as the prime example he uses, turning food crops like corn into ethanol gas.
Right. You take massive tracts of arable land, land that by all biological logic should be growing food to feed human beings, and you repurpose it to grow ethanol just to keep cars running.
And the real world result of that, global food prices spike.
Right.
Poor populations in developing nations literally starve because they can't afford basic staples.
But the GDP goes up. The agricultural sector shows massive growth. The green energy sector looks wildly profitable.
To McMurtry, that is not a cure at all. That is just the tumor putting on a green PR hat.
It is still sacrificing human life, sacrificing food to fuel the money sequence.
It is still strictly prioritizing the money sequence above life capital.
Precisely. And he makes a similar argument regarding wind farms.
Mm.
He makes a very clear distinction in the text between small-scale, community-owned renewable energy,
which benefits the locals and builds resilience,
and massive industrial-scale corporate wind farms.
Yeah.
He points out that these industrial arrays often severely degrade the local ecology. They kill massive numbers of migratory birds and bats. They create infrasonic noise pollution.
And they are often built with shockingly short operational lifespans.
Because the goal isn't necessarily long-term sustainable energy. The primary goal is often just to harvest massive government tax subsidies. Once the subsidies dry up, the turbines are sometimes just left to rot.
It all comes back to the core logic. If the ultimate motive is purely private profit, even the act of saving the planet will be executed in a way that continues to destroy the planet.
The life blindness infects everything it touches.
Okay, so we're looking at a system that literally eats life to generate numbers on a screen. And we all see it happening. We see the microplastics in the rain. We see the staggering wealth inequality, the burnout, the mental health crises.
It's unavoidable.
So the obvious question is, why don't we stop it? We live in democracies. We have complex legal systems. We have philosophy and ethics. Why is the immune system failing so completely?
McMurtry devotes an entire, very detailed section to this exact question. He calls it the social immune system.
He argues that societies naturally have biological defenses, just like bodies do.
Right. Critical thinking in universities, fiercely independent investigative journalism, rigorous public science, environmental regulations, labor unions. These are the societal antibodies designed to detect and neutralize threats to the public body.
But the cancer has evolved highly sophisticated ways to trick those antibodies.
It's what he terms the taboo.
The taboo of critical thought. And he is incredibly scathing about his own professional field here, academia.
He says that mainstream economists, even famous highly decorated ones like Amartya Sen, have essentially constructed a priesthood around the market.
They constantly claim that economics is a value-free hard science.
Right. They say, look, we are just like physicists studying gravity. We just observe the natural, inevitable forces of supply and demand. We don't make moral judgments.
But McMurtry points out that is a total illusion. They aren't value-free at all. They are completely obsessed with value, but only one very specific pathological kind of value.
They have one absolute unshakable moral dogma: money growth is good. That is the baseline assumption of the entire discipline.
And if you question that baseline, if you stand up and say, hey, maybe we shouldn't grow the economy this quarter if it means driving another species to extinction, or maybe we shouldn't pass this trade deal if it destroys a million working class families.
You aren't engaged in a rigorous debate. You're immediately dismissed as irrational. You're told you don't understand basic economics. You are labeled as purely political while they claim to be objective.
You become invisible to the system. You don't get academic tenure. Your research doesn't get the big corporate grants.
It creates a profound systemic blindness. We are allowed to see and complain about the individual symptoms, the smog, the poverty, but we are strictly forbidden from naming the underlying disease.
We are taught to think of the market as a force of nature, or even like a deity, the invisible hand, something that simply cannot be questioned by mortals.
And beyond the academic camouflage, there is the heavy legal armor protecting the tumor, corporate personhood.
This is one of those legal concepts that if you honestly explain it to an alien visiting Earth, they would think we were completely insane.
It is the ultimate legal mutation.
Under the law, corporations are literally treated as persons.
They enjoy the rights of human citizens. They have freedom of speech, which the courts have interpreted to mean the unlimited right to spend money influencing democratic elections. They have protection from unreasonable search and seizure.
But they have none of the biological vulnerabilities or moral responsibilities of an actual human person.
They enjoy limited liability. If a corporation's actions lead to the deaths of thousands of people through negligence, you can't put the corporation itself in a prison cell. You can't execute a corporation for manslaughter.
It is immortal, and it is legally shielded from the consequences of its own feeding process.
And it gets even more extreme on the international level. They can actually sue sovereign governments.
Yes, that part in the text about the international tribunals absolutely blew my mind.
The investor state dispute settlement mechanisms, the ISDS tribunals.
Explain how those work, because it's vital.
Okay. If a democratic country passes a new environmental law to protect its groundwater from toxic runoff, And that new law interferes with a foreign mining corporation's expected future profits. That corporation can drag the country into a secretive, corporate-run tribunal.
And sue the taxpayers for billions of dollars in lost future profits.
Yes. It is the mechanism of total metastasis.
It is literally the tumor suing the host organism for trying to administer chemotherapy.
It establishes the absolute legal supremacy of the cancer over the life of the host. The rights of the money sequence to infinitely expand supersede the rights of the human population to simply survive.
Okay. I really feel the weight of this right now. It feels so massive, so deeply embedded in our laws, our currency, our daily routines. It feels completely unstoppable. But we promised the listeners a cure at the beginning of this deep dive. We aren't just going to leave people staring into the void.
No, we are not. Section 5 of the text pivots dramatically. It introduces the cure, the civil commons.
What exactly is the civil commons?
The civil commons is McMurtry's reality check. He is saying, stop looking at the hypnotic matrix of the market and look down at the solid ground you are actually standing on. The civil commons is defined as any social construct where access is universal and it is distributed based on human need, not the ability to pay.
Give me the list from the source. What actually counts as the civil commons?
It is the invisible infrastructure we rely on every single minute of the day. Human language itself is the primary example. You don't pay a private royalty fee every time you use the word apple.
Right. It belongs to all of us.
The concept of the rule of law. Public sidewalks. Clean air standards. The fire department. Public libraries. The original open architecture of the internet. Universal healthcare systems.
These are systems where society at some point agreed to share the resource to protect it from the money sequence because universal access benefits the survival of the whole.
And his central radical argument is that this, the civil commons, is the only thing that actually drives human progress.
He totally flips the standard historical script. We are always told that competitive markets created modern civilization.
He says that is historically backwards. The civil commons created the stability, the health, and the trust that allowed a market to even exist in the first place.
Right. Without a healthy, educated population, without public roads to transport goods, without courts to enforce contracts, you can't have a market. You can't sell anything.
The market is entirely reliant on the host. It is a parasite riding on the back of the massive productive power of the civil commons. The cure to the cancer is simply recognizing that the host is inherently vastly stronger than the parasite. The civil commons is the only mechanism that has ever advanced human evolution.
Okay, but how do we practically weaponize the civil commons today? How do we actually shrink the tumor when the tumor currently holds all the financial power?
He proposes a very specific structural shift in the vascular system of the economy, public banking.
This circles right back to that 97% debt figure we talked about earlier.
Exactly. Right now, private for-profit banks control the blood supply of the economy, the money creation, and they charge a toll, which is interest, on almost every single dollar that exists.
So they drain the host constantly.
McMurtry argues that sovereign democratic governments must reclaim their constitutional power to create money. Not to print wildly and cause hyperinflation like Weimar Germany, but to back that money directly with public productivity.
Break that down for us. Explain the difference between the current system and public banking in a real-world scenario.
Okay, let's say a government needs to build a vital new bridge. Under the current cancer stage, the government usually borrows the money to build it from private bondholders and massive banks.
And the taxpayers pay interest on that massive debt for the next 30 or 40 years.
Right. So by the time the debt is paid, the bridge ends up costing the public 3 or 4 times its actual physical price in materials and labor. The excess wealth is siphoned off to the financial sector.
But in a public banking system,
the sovereign government, through a public bank, simply issues the fiat money to build the bridge directly at zero or near zero interest. The real, tangible asset backing that new money is the physical bridge itself and the massive economic efficiency and activity that bridge creates for the society.
So you completely cut out the parasitic middleman. You cut out the rent seeker.
It instantly frees the host from the artificial debt trap. It allows a society to invest directly in life capital. We could be retrofitting our cities for energy efficiency, transitioning the power grid, properly paying people to care for the elderly, and we could do it without needing the permission of private profit seekers.
You no longer have to ask the paralyzing question, is this socially necessary project profitable for a bank? You only have to ask, is it necessary for human life to flourish?
It sounds incredibly radical to our modern ears, But he points out in the text that sound economics has long understood this. We have done it successfully in the past, before the mutation fully took hold.
And the source material provides clear proof of concept with case studies. The comparison between Norway and Canada is particularly striking.
It is a stark, undeniable contrast.
It was honestly a painful section for me to read, and I think it will be for anyone who lives in a deeply resource-rich country that is somehow constantly running a deficit and cutting public services.
Both Norway and Canada had massive, incredibly valuable oil and gas wealth discovered within their borders in the 20th century.
But their trajectories were totally different. Let's look at Norway first.
Norway treated that oil wealth primarily as life capital, or at least as the property of the civil commons. They maintained strict public control. They heavily taxed the foreign extraction companies, and they used those massive revenues to build a sovereign wealth fund that is now worth well over $1 trillion, strictly for the benefit of their citizens.
They retained the biological and financial value within the host body.
Now look at Canada. Canada fully embraced the mutation of the money sequence. They aggressively privatized their state oil companies, they radically lowered royalty rates to attract foreign corporate investment, and they essentially sold off the long-term asset to transnational corporations.
And the result of that privatization?
The vast majority of the public revenue from that one-time natural inheritance is largely gone, siphoned off to private shareholders globally. Meanwhile, the severe environmental damage, the polluted water tables, the abandoned wells, those remain for the Canadian public to deal with. Norway has a massive savings account securing their social safety net for generations. Canada has giant holes in the ground and structural budget deficits.
That is the choice laid out in the text. It really is a binary fork in the road.
McMurtry is very clear on this. He says this is not a petty debate about left versus right politics. Those are just tribal distractions designed to keep the host confused. This is quite literally about life versus death.
Do we want an economic system that actually mimics a healthy, sustainable ecosystem, prioritizing universal access to human needs? Or do we want to stubbornly stick with the cancer program until the host organism completely collapses?
He even redefines the classic environmental 3 R's of eco-literacy to fit this new paradigm. It is a total operating system update, way beyond just reminding people to recycle their soda cans.
Right. Let's go through his version of the 3 R's because they are powerful, starting with reduce.
In a life capital economy, reduce doesn't mean imposing cruel austerity on poor people who already lack the basics. It means aggressively reducing the massive material excess that serves absolutely no life function. It means rationing carbon usage. It means actively stopping the production of toxic, useless junk that solely exists to fuel the money sequence.
And reuse.
Reuse means the absolute end of planned obsolescence. If a corporation deliberately engineers a refrigerator or a smartphone to break down in 3 years, just to force the consumer to buy a new one under a life capital standard, that is treated as a profound economic crime against the biosphere. Things must be built to be durable and repairable.
And finally, recycle.
Recycle means striving for zero waste. In the natural world, in a healthy biology, waste from one process is always food for another. There are no garbage dumps in a forest. The human economy must be re-engineered to close the loop entirely.
It really is a complete fundamental shift in how we measure success as a species.
It is. But the crucial takeaway from the text is that the hardware to do this, the civil commons, is already built. We live in it. It surrounds us. We just need to stop allowing the cancer to suppress our social immune system. We have to wake up, collectively, to the diagnosis.
And honestly, that is exactly what this deep dive is trying to achieve today. Just naming the thing accurately. Because you cannot effectively fight a terminal cancer if you are continually gaslit into believing it is just a healthy growth spurt.
Exactly. Once you truly grasp the concept of the lifeline logic, you cannot unsee it. You see it in the layout of the grocery store. You see it behind the headlines in the evening news. You see it hiding in your retirement portfolio.
It changes your entire worldview.
And that profound recognition, that shock of seeing the tumor for what it is, that is the very first step of the cure.
I want to leave everyone listening with a final provocative challenge derived straight from McMurtry's logic. It is a tough question to sit with, but I think it's necessary. Look critically at your own life. Look at your daily job, your investments, the things you buy without thinking. Ask yourself, how much of your precious energy, your limited time on this earth, is just blindly feeding the money sequence, just helping abstract numbers go up for someone else?
And conversely, how much of your daily life is actively building life capital, creating actual health, deep knowledge, community connection, and ecological resilience.
And if you find, as many of us do, that the current system makes it incredibly exhausting and difficult to choose life, well, now you finally know exactly why. It is biologically designed that way. But the immune system starts with us recognizing the threat. Thanks for guiding us through this incredibly intense pathology report today.
It was my pleasure. Let's hope for a swift remission.
And thank you all for listening to The Deep Dive. We will see you next time.